Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain. I'm a psychotherapist and the founder of the Awareness Integration Theory. And hello to Sean, our director in our studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our mind, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I will share the tip of the week about having wonder and curiosity instead of getting stuck with our righteousness. And then I will talk about why people make us angry in the Ask Me segment. Yeah, someone asked that, so I'm gonna answer it. And then I am so excited and honored to bring you Dr. Jeffrey Zeig, a psychologist, the founder and the director of the Milton Erickson Foundation. Having studied intermittently with Dr. Erickson for more than 6 years, he has authored and co-authored more than 20 books that appears in 12 foreign languages. Dr. Zeig is the architect of the Evolution of Psychotherapy Conferences, which is considered the most important conference in the history of psychotherapy. All the who's who are there. And we will talk about the state of depression and how to shift your perspective on that. I love to hear from you. So connect with me through my website, fujian.com, and follow my social media and message me with your comments and topics of interest. But first, here is the tip of the week.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zeig. You can get it now at fujian.com or amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, the Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Hey, this is Dr. Fujian Zeig again, and this is the tip of the week. So I feel blessed this week to observe children's emotions and experiences and how that relates to us as an adult. What I've been privy to is the purity of the emotions of young children as they are felt and expressed, the need for love and caring and the willingness to let go and forgive the world outside when it is not to their liking, when they experience love and care from their surrounding. The flow of information as it comes in from the outside world, how they incorporate and categorize it into their system, and how each one of them is a little teacher who teaches their younger sibling immediately and even correct you as you are making a mistake or say things that are not like a match to what they want to hear. So, for example, the cutest five-year-old girl was told to cut her nails so that they won't scratch her
or others and keep her nails clean. She saw my nails getting a little bit longer. And she says to me, "You need to cut your nails so that it doesn't scratch yourself or me." And when I answer, "Thank you for letting me know. I like my nails and I want them long and I would like them actually to get longer. And I think they're pretty. And maybe when you're older, you may choose to keep them long too." She looked at me trying to figure out why pretty nails could not be there for little girls and it had to be there for big girls. So a week later, as she saw me opening something with kind of like my nails, she said, "Oh, you must be keeping your nails long so that you could open up things with it." Then we were picking up label stamps and I was going like this with my long nails and they were being useful to pull up the stamps. And then she says, "Let me use your nail to do this. They're pretty useful now." So this aspect of learning, using what is learned, sharing what is learned, and the openness to see and hear information that is the opposite of what is learned before and instructed, and find new reasons for its applicability are a spectacular process of human beings. When do we lose this amazing capability? We close down and say that information I have acquired so far is enough. And now I will become righteous about it. Or I will no longer accept any new or different or opposite views or all views that are not similar to mine. And obviously they're wrong. And mine is the only one that is right. Well, we've seen this in this, environment that we're in. And you could see that in anywhere. You could go see that in work, in anywhere, family setting. So if the above sentences seem a little bit exaggerated to you, I invite you to see in which area of your life you have become righteous and no longer opening yourself up to new information, to different or opposing information. Is it your intimate relationship? Is it your career? Parenting style? Views on politics, views on society? Where is it? As you notice the areas of your life that you have closed yourself to new ideas and views, check to see what happened. What event in your life made you close down? See if you would be open to considering expanding your experience, your outlook, and your life paradigm. There's a vast amount of knowledge and wisdom above and beyond you, waiting for you to experience it. Some people experience fear of expansion, fear of the unknown, and want to stick to the limited known knowledge to feel safe and secure. Ask if keeping a limiting structure would give them a guarantee of repeated safe results, soon to be stripped of that delusion from the process of life itself. Limiting yourself and becoming righteous does not guarantee safety and security. It only aggravates you and everyone else around you. You're not intended to be limited. Look at what human beings have accomplished. You deserve to experience it all. So let's bring the part of us that we each possess in our childhood back to the present, bring it up, and bring it to the everyday living and enjoy life. Bring the essence of wonder, curiosity, openness to all that life brings, and forgiveness when faced with adversaries. For learning more observational skills and tools to raise your self-esteem, go to my book, Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it.
is Dr. Fujian again. This is the Ask Me segment. A wonderful lady has asked me, how come some people love to get me angry and get me pissed off, especially in my Facebook? They start putting comments and sentences there, and they give comments on my stuff and other people, and it really enrages me. And it seems like they really like to do this. How come? Well, I can't read their mind, but I'm going to tell you some general aspect. First of all, it could be that they're not doing it to you, that maybe they're angry themselves, they're anxious, they're depressed, there's something going on with them, and they're just trying to share. And the same way with you, as you're getting triggered, then you are getting all of these different comments in social media and it's triggering you, that maybe the same thing that's triggering them, and they're giving themselves the right to just kind of like express immediately, give comment. You know, social media is one of those concepts that we can do whatever we want without necessarily being responsible. We could go with under different names and just as emotion shows up, kind of like vomit it out and put it out there, express it. And if you don't want, then you shut it down and it doesn't matter what happens to you. So there could be people who are utilizing it that way. Or it is personal to you. They have a message to give you. They're upset with you. They want your attention. They want you to hear them. So first of all, see if the person or people you're talking about, is it that they really are trying to say something to you and you're not listening? And they're kind of like making it louder and louder and more public. So maybe you listen. They're knocking at your door. So if it's somebody you know and you think it is truly personal, then my suggestion is open the door. Invite and listen from your heart beyond your expectations of them to say it another way or talk to you another way or believe you or accept you the way you are. Begin looking at, can you hear them and can you find out what it is that they want from you first? And if you can't offer that to them, that's okay. Then at least you'll let them know, I heard you. I know this is what you want. This is what I'm capable of giving or wanting to give. And beyond that, I can't give you more attention on this. If it's someone has a different opinion than you, it's okay. You know, they can share their opinion. You can share your opinion and all will be well. If you really assess that this is not to you, this is just someone who is sharing their own view, but then you pick it up and you bring it into your world and then you get upset, then I would say just for you to look at, can you be okay with other people doing what they need to do? If you don't like them in your Facebook, it's okay. You can let them go. You can unfollow them, allow them to unfollow you. And you don't need to bring them into your world if you think that these are people who are just upset and they like to share their upset and you don't want that upset to be triggering you. Another concept is, what themes are triggering you to be so upset? And maybe you've become a little bit righteous about it. And maybe you need to look at, what is it about those concepts or your background or your experiences that really, really affects you when somebody talks about those issues or treats you in a particular way? So it becomes a space of awareness for you to be able to release all of those buttons that have been installed in you, which are really getting pushed by others, and you're allowing it to be pushed by others. So either close the door for others to push it or begin dismantling those buttons so that you don't become so limited and constantly as if like you've given your leash, your emotional leash to another group and they can just yank it however they want to. And as if you are powerless against them yanking your leash. You're not. Take back your own power. Take back your own leash and take care of yourself in any format that you need to. If you need to ignore it, go ahead. If you need to take the lesson, bring it in and really look at what yourself is and create growth for yourself, then let's do that. I hope that answered her question and all of yours. Thank you.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Well, welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I am so excited to have Dr. Jeffrey Zeik with me. He's a psychologist. He's the founder and the director of the Milton Erickson Foundation. Having studied intermittently with Dr. Erickson for more than 6 years, he edited, co-edited, authored, and co-authored more than 20 books that appears in 12 foreign languages. Dr. Zeik is the architect of one of the most amazing conferences, the Evolution of Psychotherapy, and it is considered the most important conferences in the history of psychotherapy. The who's who are there. He organizes the Brief Therapy and the Couples Conference, and he's the president of Zeik, Tucker, and Tyson Publisher in the Behavioral Sciences and the Erickson Foundation Press. I am so honored and excited to have you with me.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
I always say, and people who have watched our show together before, is that you've inspired me so much with who you are and with your creation of bringing the psychology world together. I've learned so much from the opportunity that you've created, and many, many therapists, I know that they would have never had this opportunity unless you created it. So thank you from the psychology world.
Well, thank you.
You have an eloquent way of creating communication with people. And you come from such a diverse way. And I remember I was talking to someone who wanted to invite you for a hypnosis seminars. And he said, what is your experience when you listen to Jeff Zeik? And I said, whenever I sit with Dr. Jeff Zeik, I look at him, I'm like, that is brilliance happening up there. I don't know if I can ever do that, because the brilliance of how you create and formulate sentences and words and your tonality in how you bring and land communication for the person who's in front of you. It's an amazing task. I know we got to talk about depression today, but I just was so impressed with that. I just wanted to share that with you.
I have a new website that I just launched called emotionalimpact.net. And it's a project where I interview artists. The first one is I'm interviewing Stan Lee of Marvel Comic Books. And I'm talking with him about how to set up a story. Now, I've interviewed other people, Richard Sherman, who's he and his brother wrote the music for Mary Poppins and got a Presidential Arts Medal as well as two Academy Awards. So I've found excellence in communicators that are outside of the field of psychotherapy. What is it that a composer does? What is it that a storyteller does? What is it that a poet does? And how do we understand the evocative grammar of art? And then how can we bring the evocative grammar of art not only into our professional life, but into our personal life? Because when you want somebody to realize something, you need to use a different form of communication than when you want to instruct somebody with something.
Absolutely. On the topic that we wanted to talk about, which is depression, which obviously, you know, at this point, I think is the number one leading condition or an illness across the world, especially after COVID, which it kind of like skyrocketed. A concept of depression, although, you know, many believe that, and there are elements of it that can be chemical and are chemical, but a lot more of depression around the world are more societal. And the story that someone has created in their own world. I remember my own growing up, I could tell you specifically that I've had dysthymia for most of my life, a low chronic depression until I, you know, went to psychotherapy and kind of like released myself from it. So there's definitely a storytelling that is there, the communication that we tell ourselves. And if you were going to share with us, how do you see that sort of communication that happens internally that creates and leads up to that type of depression?
Well, I also came from a depressed family. My parents were taking antidepressants the day that they came out. And I, you know, when I started in graduate school, I had this idea of a family feeling, which is like an heirloom that is transmitted from generation to generation. I could go back many generations, as far as I could go back, and also know that there was depression that existed. I'm sure that my mother's depression had a biological basis, but when we had dinner, like let's say I was in high school, President Kennedy was shot, I came home and everybody was depressed. Now, when I started doing family therapy in the early 1970s, and there was some similar tragedy, and I was dealing with a family from a different ethnic group than mine, they were angry. I think these people don't know what to feel. They should be depressed, because when a tragedy happens, you should be depressed. And then I had other families that were guilty. What did we do wrong? And then I had other families that were frightened. What's going to happen to us? And then I realized that this family feeling, depression in my case, was passed on over the dinner table in response to the way that my family dealt with external circumstances. Being, I knew that I didn't need to be depressed. Even though I probably have the genetics for depression, I don't have to activate those genetics. And so the knowledge of that simple pattern was enough for me, as the knowledge for you was getting therapy and realizing you don't have to suffer from a dysthymic disorder. Certainly there are some depressions that are biologically based and need to be treated and respond very well to chemical means, but not every depression needs to be treated with a chemical formula.
And especially even if it is a chemical formula, that what I've noticed is that, you know, the chemical just doesn't show you coping skills and all the ways of handling the depression anyway. So you might shift kind of like the cloud in that are there and kind of bring them about and make it a bit sunny. But if I've been used to a particular way of storytelling to myself, or the way that I see myself, or the stories that I make about myself or the world, that type of storytelling, if it's not shifted, or the way that I can cope with, for example, a family that is depressed, or people around me who are, you know, in acting in a particular way, which keeps creating a result, which then they will feel victimized by the result again. And there's a cycle that goes on. There's a way to kind of like be aware of that storytelling. And then with your way of evocative communication, challenging it, shifting it, and bringing it into another form of a storytelling. Could you share a bit about that?
Yeah. Well, one thing to keep in mind is depression is not depression is not depression. There's not one single depression. We nominalize a verb, depressing. People are depressing themselves. They don't feel it as that. They feel as if the depression just happens to them, but they're depressing themselves. How are you depressing yourself is something that I could ask to an intelligent client. But if you think about the component parts, Mrs. Smith, how do you know you're depressed? I have dark images. Mr. Smith, how do you know you're depressed? I have negative thoughts. Mr. Jones, how do you know you're depressed? I'm withdrawn from other people. Mrs. Jones, how do you know you're depressed? I don't have any goals. So when you ask somebody about the characteristics that are central to them saying I'm depressed, there are cognitive, behavioral, affective, attitudinal, perceptual, memory, could be even postural aspects that let somebody know, energetic aspects that let somebody know that they're depressed. There's not one depression. So it's a matter of understanding what is the central theme that this person uses to say, I'm depressed. Now, if you go to a physician, the physician's going to prescribe a medication for you. But if you go to the person who sells mattresses, he's going to say that everything will be better once you have a new mattress. So a psychologist, as we are, we would look for social things that we could do that would help people. But it's a matter of targeting a component and not trying to treat the category. Depression is a category, and it's an easy term to use because it communicates some things that are important, but it may not communicate the things that are most important in making a change in the system. So it's looking for a peripheral aspect of the system that can make a change that makes a difference. And one change, or a few changes, can change the quality of the system. If you wake up tomorrow morning and you say, it's a beautiful day in Southern California, I think I'll be depressed. Well, what would you do? You would withdraw, you would position yourself as a victim of your circumstances, you wouldn't have goals, you wouldn't use your vision, you would emphasize the tactile sensations that were involved. But then you begin to understand that depressing is a complex of elements, and find one of those elements that can be changed. And by virtue of using psychotherapy techniques, because it's very hard to change the system from the inside, you need somebody from the outside that can help you to make a change that makes a difference. If you know, the easiest thing to say to a depressed person is cheer up, it's a beautiful day, go out and enjoy it. But people can't follow that proscription. But if you can get somebody involved with experiencing the wonderful eroticism of being alive, it's just a wonderful thing to be alive. It's amazing to be alive. And if somebody starts to realize that, that may be the formula that breaks a crystallized structure. It's as if the depression is something that's crystallized, and if you could just find a facet, it may be that the whole system changes when you find a way of making a change in some peripheral aspect of the totality of the system. There's not one depression, except if you're in the medical field, then you have a criteria, and depression is depression is depression. But for us as psychotherapists, what I instruct my students is don't treat the category, treat the components, understand the component structure, create a map. How does this person do depression?
So Dr. Zeig, if we look at the category, do you presume that the reason, for example, depression has, out of all the conditions besides the heart problem and all of that, the medical conditions has become so prevalent around the world? Although comfort is becoming more around the world, poverty is going less before, in comparison with before, the concept of poverty has changed. What a poverty looked like, 100 years ago is very different than a poverty looks like today. Eradication of a lot of diseases and all of that. What do you, and suppose this category of depression has gotten, consume the whole world, and it keeps going higher and higher, although psychotherapy is, hundred some years old and obviously around the world now, and medications are around the world. What do you assume?
Oh, one answer, we can think that if you live in a post-scarcity consciousness, like a society where the consciousness is beyond scarcity, if you're struggling for shelter and you're struggling for food, you don't have time to think about your psychological, social problems. You are involved in dealing with scarcity. But when we come to a post-scarcity society, it's easier for you to think about your thinking or your feeling or your existential situation. And we're all in a remarkably bleak existential situation. We're all going to die. So now the question is not whether to be depressed or not depressed. The question is, what can we do that's meaningful? What gives our life meaning? If what gives our life meaning is children or work or creativity or learning, what is it that gives your life meaning? Focus on the trajectory, because it's a little bit like a karate master hears the board, the karate master needs to break the board. The board, in this case, is our existential situation. We face death. But the focus is for the karate master is not to see the board, it's to wind up beyond the board. And that is to do things meaningful with the time that we're allotted. It's meaningful for me, Fujian, to be here with you. If it wasn't meaningful, I wouldn't be doing it. So as long as we're focused on imbuing our day with meaning, and we can think about what is the meaning of what we're doing, that can be palliative in many cases, not every case. You know, people go through a cardiac arrest or a cardiac surgery, and they're depressed, and there's a biological letdown. 80% of women, by some people's statistics, after having a child will have a postpartum depression. There are biological factors, but not everything is biological. For the people for whom an antidepressant works, it's a miracle. And suddenly it takes the bottom out and they're not crashing down into the horrors of depression. They can begin to move forward in their life. But if we can keep in mind meaning, what has intrinsic meaning, and there's no objective standard for what is meaningful in somebody's life, but you know, for me, pursuing service, doing good things in the world, making the world of psychotherapy a little bit better place by virtue of my presence on the planet, loving my family, those things are meaningful, and those give substance that are antidepressants as well as a chemical antidepressant.
So one of the things I'm hearing from your conversation is that we get to have the luxury of time for pondering versus always being in action. And maybe one of the things to be able to do is to focus on action, move toward what it is that we want to do in a meaningful way, or pursue things in action that are meaningful to us versus sitting and pondering about what was and what is and what will be in a negative way.
Yes, we could discriminate between depression and despair. Like depression is when the internal parent beats up on the internal child, you're not good enough. And despair is when the internal child looks out through the internal adult and says, is this all there is in life? And sometimes we think of grief or despair as depression, but they're not the same animal. Grief is different. Grief is something that would be normal for experiencing a significant loss. And we grieve, and that seems to be a biologically based emotion. And but despair, understanding our existential situation, our purpose in life, is a different kind of animal than grief or depression. But we tend to group things for the ease of communicating them. And sometimes as a therapist, I could say to someone, you don't have depression, you have despair. Or you don't have depression, you have grief, and try to reformulate an understanding when the natural way of categorizing that is to say, I'm depressed. But sometimes it's not about depression as much as it's about an existential perspective on how do you live life with substance and perspective, have a perspective point out there that draws you forward happily into your future.
And as the COVID has kind of come upon the whole world, there's a different outlook, because I think that, like what you said, we could look at it as a category of depression under COVID, but there is so many different ones. As you were talking about, somebody lost their job, so there's an issue of financial anxiety and about what to do. Another person is going through the despair of, is this all that is? Another one is going through the anxiety of facing death, and then the despair of, was it all that? That's it? happen to die, yeah. And that's all. Or the connection with humanity, or the taking away all the pleasures in a way of, you know, people who are used to restaurants, eating, food, travel, socialization, all of that has been taken away. So I'm also hearing that the category of depression that we're putting post-COVID has so many of the different elements into it that creates this level. And what are your thoughts about the
very intelligent, astute analysis. There's a reactive depression, which is not a biologically based depression or a depressive lifestyle. But some situations are so oppressive that you could have a situational anxiety or a situational depression, a reactive anxiety, a reactive depression. The circumstances are difficult. Okay, well, then what do we do that deals adequately with difficult circumstances? We will all face circumstances that we could be depressed about, illness or limitations of the COVID situation. Now, how are you going to make the best of this situation and use the limitations of the situation in the most effective way? Every art has limitations. A poet has a page, a musician has an instrument, a choreographer has a stage to dance on. So every art has limitations, and every art is defined by those limitations. Now, within the limitations of painting, having a canvas and colors, there's an infinite number of things that you can do. You're still dealing with the limitation. So let's not focus on the weeds, let's focus on the flowers. Let's not focus on the limitations, let's focus on the possibilities that are inherent within the fact that we're limited. You know, we're limited by our art, our circumstances.
I was listening to one of your lectures in the evolution of psychotherapy and the evocative communication and how you set up the different versions of it. And I was just hearing you come through with that kind of a conversation, which you bring different versions of ideas, which have the same theme. And then you start with one, and then you go to the next until you open up, you know, the theme shows up at the topic that we're talking about. And I was just hearing that. The element that I'm also hearing with your conversation is sometimes we get so bogged down in one area, as if this area, we only have an issue at this area that we can't fix. And then when we open it up and see how the same construct of maybe powerlessness or limitation or many of these are there in different areas of life, and somehow we've accepted it. And then when suddenly shows up in this area, we don't accept it. And then you're opening it up as, you know, there are things that happen that I accept in my driving and driving rules. And if I, you know, I'm powerless against many of the things that happen, I can only be semi-powerful with what I can do with the steering wheel and the two pedals. And that's pretty much it that I can do. And then everything else is pretty much powerless. And I kind of just put myself out there and do it every day. And then yet when it comes to the COVID or many of these other aspects, I get so boggled up with the concept of I'm powerless and what am I going to do? And it's like, well, you do that constantly with driving. You constantly do that in every area of your life. And how can you bring it back and look at it from that perspective in this area of life so it can release you from that fear?
It's so hard to do. And what you're saying is so intelligent, because let's say that there's a jet pilot who comes to me and he does a test pilot and he flies planes 2 times the speed of sound upside down, but he gets absolutely paralyzed when he has to stand in front of an audience and tell his findings. On the other hand, you could have somebody who speaks to thousands of people and is comfortable and at ease, but is terrified about getting into a jet plane. Now, you should be able to say, excuse me, Mr. Pilot, but if you can relax Mach 2 flying a 60-degree bank inverted, you should be able to use the same relaxation in front of an audience. It just doesn't work. And it's the same as saying to a depressed person, cheer up, it's a beautiful day, the sun is shining, you can go out and enjoy yourself and realize some of the beauty of nature. The direct approach, there's some things that need to be elicited. Every depressed person has a resource for being able to enjoy the world because they've done it at some time in their life. It's just that that is compartmentalized and it's not immediately accessible. So there has to be some way of beginning to awaken a person. A rough, a crude example would be a joke. You know, you could say to somebody, laugh, I want you to laugh right now. It's not going to work. You need to engage the person in a joke that they will find humorous and that evokes laughter. So there's some things that can be informed and some things that need to be evoked. And you can't just say to a depressed person, you know, well, you've had this history of being a little boy and being excited about riding your bicycle and being totally engaged and immersed in that. Just do it now in your life. But if somebody says it to you and they say it to you in a compelling way, coming from the outside, there can be an awakening. It's just really hard to change that from the inside because you don't have the same leverage. But when there's a trained listener, a therapist who understands and empathizes and knows something about life and human psychology and the process of change, just a little thing can awaken a realization that brings joy back to life. The problem is not teaching people how not to be depressed. The problem is awakening the realizations that are dormant, that are already there inside them. Every depressed person knows how to be happy because they've done it before. But we have to awaken people to the capacities that have been dormant asleep inside them, which is one of the paradoxes of my using hypnosis, because it sounds like you use hypnosis to put people to sleep, but you really use hypnosis to awaken people to their potentials.
And the other conversations that you were having, which as long as I've known you, your hand has been in different bowls of life, which was movie, talking to directors, looking at, you know, emphasizing on different aspects of how symbolization in movies and pictures show up. You just talked about music, poetry. And it's interesting the way you were saying it. It reminded me of many times, you know, I'm from Iran and I have a lot of Iranian clients, and we have this tremendous rich poetry and a culture that shows up. And many times it's been, you know, in therapy, we're talking about something and then suddenly the next week, they come up with this amazing poetry and they say, I was reading and then I heard Rumi said this, and then it just, it opened up everything for me. And it's those going from the limitation of only looking at one aspect of pondering and opening and analyzing and shifting and seeing what the messages that are out there from everything that we see. You watch a sitcom in a television show and suddenly opens up something about you. So being open to all of these ideas that people are in different languages of art and pictures and all of the other types of arts are also giving messages of humanity. Everything we're going through, it's being shown somehow. And as I was hearing you, is opening to that area and picking them up and allowing to receive and create awareness.
Right. You know, there's a pattern that we know, but we may not activate or realize that we know. And that is the development of a concept. So, and also the strategic process. So we get into the aspect of communication that I enjoy learning about and practicing. So if a poet is writing about a tree, the poet starts off with something commonplace. There's a tree. And then begins to develop so that you feel the concept of tree, a small tree, a green tree, a tree that is extending its branches into the sky, a tree that meets the sky with its own greenery that opens to enjoy the warmth and build from that warmth. And that wasn't very poetic, but it was the idea of taking something and then developing it so that the concept comes alive. Now, we see that, and we know that in poetry, we know that in music, we know that in literature, we know that in movies and plays and opera. It's the same pattern that happens across arts, that somebody comes up with a simple concept and then develops it strategically by using metaphor, analogy, by using unusual sentence forms, unusual gestures and postures. And it's that that makes the concept come alive. And so what I do with my students is to try to teach them how to reference what they know about the staged world, about how music works. How does Beethoven develop a theme, 1, 2, 3 down, and develop that theme so that it creates an entire symphony and you feel the tension of hope versus fate as it's portrayed by the different of ways in which he inverts the theme and embellishes the theme. And good writers do this, and good therapists should do the same. But if you're a team member and you have an unmotivated member in the team and you say to the team member, you're not motivated, be motivated. It's the same as saying to a depressed person, cheer up. Every unmotivated person has been motivated sometime in their life. And they need to awaken that motivation, but that requires using forms of communication that are more familiar in art than they are in science. In science, you're dealing with a situation where you're dealing with facts. And if you know that if you sum all of the numbers from 1 to 100, 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4, you will always get 5,050. Is a simpler algorithm for doing that, which is 1 plus 100 is 101, 2 plus 99 is 101, 3 plus 98 is 101, 50 times 101 is 5,050. That's just a simpler algorithm, but it's a concrete process because you're going to find something that's factual at the end of the arithmetic, whichever way you do it. But if you say, be happy, or you say be connected, or you say be creative, or be motivated, or be responsible. If you're talking with somebody about realizing a concept, you can't use a scientific formula that you would use for adding numbers or sending a rocket ship to the moon. It's a different area of communication that requires a different form of communication that's well known to all of us, because we all read literature, or we all go to the movies, or we all listen to music. And if we study the imperative grammar, the evocative grammar of art, when we want to communicate a concept to someone, we can reference what we know about art. I'll go on one more minute. Is that okay, Fujian?
Oh, please, yes.
Yeah, so you said that I was doing a process before. It's a process of using recursions. Now that is one simple form of embellishing a concept. Let's say that this is something that any great orator would use, like Bill Clinton, a wonderful orator, incredible speaker. And he's talking about the economy. And he says, we need to work with sound economic principles. We need to have fiscal responsibility. We need to have budgetary confinements that allows us to build this economy. And everybody's going, whoa. Now, actually, he just said the same thing 3 times, but he used slightly different words to embellish the concept. So when I'm you know, doing hypnosis, and maybe the concept that I want to do to elicit is calm. You can feel at ease. There can be a sense of peace. You can enjoy the tranquility of this moment. Well, I've just said the same thing three times with a slight variation. Now, this is the same thing that Beethoven does with 1, 2, 3 down. And he has slight variations that make 1, 2, 3 down come alive. So this concept goes across art. Now, once I realized that recursions are ways of building a concept and making it come more alive, I don't think about it anymore. I've just practiced this so many times that it's like tying my shoes. It's in my procedural memory. I don't have to think about it. I can think about embellishing things in other ways. But in the field of psychotherapy, this has not been something that is taught. Therapists don't learn to think about the palette, the full palette of communication that is available to them and how they can embellish communication in the process of getting an understanding. I can eat healthy to a realization, I'm a healthy eater. Now, there needs to be a jump to go from the concept to the realization. And that's usually an evocative experience. Oh my gosh, I can be a healthy eater. I am a healthy eater. And that evocative moment can be built depending on who it is that you're talking to. And if you're reading Rumi, suddenly some concept that has been there in your mind crystallizes because of the beautiful poetic way that he has built the concept, and you realize things rather than understand them.
I also heard something in your conversation, which not only it's being said in different way, but each of the different way, as I heard you and then going into art, touches a different part. So comes from a different angle of the senses. So one might be appealing to the conceptual analyzation. Another one would be a pictorial. Another one would be a physical, like the example you were saying. The one was the enjoyment and going into your body and feeling the feeling or the tranquility. And then another one was the concept or the picture. So it becomes a full experience for the person. And yep. And for our audience who are listening and even can open themselves up, because obviously one of the issues with the depression is you lose pleasure. Like even the things you use to have pleasure, you won't have pleasure. It's opening themselves up to different modes of pleasure, where it could be different. Maybe they couldn't have it before. They could have this type of pleasure before COVID, and they don't feel comfortable right now to have that. But to see what else is out there from different angles that they could experience the experience of some sort of pleasure as whatever is offered at this time. Right. Dr. Zag, in 1 minute or so, if you wanted to conclude about something that we haven't talked about and you really want people to know, what would that be?
Well, what you're saying about depression is anhedonia, the inability to experience pleasure. And it's one of the most wicked parts of depression, because the things that you did before, ride a bicycle, plant a garden, go to a movie, they don't give you pleasure. And so when you're in that state of anhedonia, it's really difficult to do things. So it's like building momentum, just do it. I know you won't feel better by virtue of doing it, but it's like you're underwater and you need to just do a couple of things to suddenly, there's a moment when you break through and you get a breath of fresh air and you feel pleasure again. But it's one of the hardest parts of working with a deep depression is this inability to experience pleasure. Woody Allen in his masterpiece, Annie Hall, wanted to originally name it anhedonia, because he was psychiatrically aware and knew the concept, but that wasn't going to sell the movie, so he named it Annie Hall. But it is a really difficult part. And yet, every depressed person who has this characteristic of anhedonia common to many depressions, has been happy and has been grounded and aware in their senses. And that can be awakened in many cases by somebody who has the astute knowledge to be able to build the momentum so that the person can begin to realize this. It's very difficult to struggle with depression on your own, and it's very difficult to have somebody within your family be able to reach you. They don't have the leverage. So reaching out, getting a therapist, getting somebody who's experienced, and there's no one right way, but you find the right person who understands you, and you can begin to build the momentum to get yourself out of that rut.
Thank you so much for the time that you allowed me. I know you are so busy and you always give me the honor of actually opening some space for me. So thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's really, I really enjoy the conversation, and it's intelligent and interesting and gives me new perspectives on thinking about things.
Thank you, everyone. Dr. Jeffrey Zeig, please go to jeffreyzeig.com. And can you say the other
emotionalimpact.net.
Emotionalimpact.net,
and you get some idea of this project on bringing the art of art into the art of communication.
Beautiful. For everyone who's out there, create an amazing world for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.